This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with actor Bryan Cranston. He's best known for playing Walter White, a chemistry teacher who became a master meth cook and outlaw on the AMC TV series Breaking Bad, which aired its final episode in 2013. Cranston currently is playing President Lyndon Johnson in the Broadway play All the Way. It's a role Cranston began performing as Breaking Bad was airing its final episodes. All the Way, which originally opened in Boston, moved to Broadway earlier this month. Let's start with a scene from All the Way. It takes place when LBJ is trying to get enough votes to pass the Civil Rights Act. Here, he's talking to Senator Hubert Humphrey, who was then the Democratic Majority Whip, trying to persuade him to get tough.
This ain't about principles. This is about votes. You know that's a problem with you liberals. You don't know how to fight. You want to get something done in the real world, Hubert, you're going to have to get your hands wet. Now you call yourself the leader of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and show me some goddamn leadership.
Bryan Cranston, welcome to Fresh Air.
That man scares me.
not nearly as much as Walt.
Thank you, Terry. It's good to be here.
So congratulations on your Broadway show. Has it been difficult to make the adjustment from speaking for a television audience to speaking in a theater and having to, you know, do theater kind of vocal projection? And ditto with the gestures. You know, like everything has to be just a little bigger on stage than in front of a camera.
Well, I don't pay too much attention to trying to make my gestures larger. I don't have to with LBJ. He was a bigger than life character, and my biggest challenge was going to keep my vocal strength. And I talked with a beautiful, talented artist named Audra McDonald, who was doing Porgy.
Oh, she's so great. Yeah.
Oh. And she was doing Porgy and Bess, and she was starting to feel the strain on her vocal cords and her ear, nose, and throat. Doctor said, I recommend strongly. In fact, I'm telling you to shut down on your one day off. Don't talk at all. And so she incorporated Mondays as her silent day. And I thought, as a preemptive strike, I'm going to do the same. So I don't talk on Mondays. I have little notepads and a whiteboard that I write notes on, and you know, I write it out and say, what is the soup, you know, and things like that.
Really?
So
you go outside. You don't just, like, stay home and not talk.
It'd be easy if you didn't leave your apartment. But no, I go outside, and I'll go to a museum or I can go to restaurants and whatnot and just – do my best, of course, not to talk.
Wait, so
I'll forget.
Does your note say, I don't talk on Mondays, so what's your soup today?
Basically, yeah. I do have one little notepad that I have that on the top of it, it says, doctor's orders, vocal rest, no talking. And I show it to people.
Wow, great.
And immediately they start whispering back to me, which is very interesting. They feel like they have to just start whispering. Oh, okay. I'll talk to you at this tone. As if that made any difference. I can hear you just fine. But what I was really faced with now is my physicality. I take on a physical nature of Lyndon Johnson on stage that is doing a little damage to me, and I need to be hyper alert of this. And it's
with the bad posture that you do.
The bad posture, and as he was always a lot heavier than I am. And I knew that in order to sustain 8 performances a week of this 3-hour play with this character who's so, you know, commanding on stage, that I needed to be in the best shape I can be and to have me physically supported. And all of a sudden I get a crink in my neck and, you know, my posture is off and I don't know how to change that. So I'm talking to some experts on how I can, you know, slightly change it on stage so that I don't go home every night with a literal pain in my neck.
Oh, absolutely. As Walter White, you became physically transformed. Walter White starts as a kind of blending in the background chemistry high school teacher, And over time, as he cooks more meth and starts doing some very evil deeds, he becomes physically transformed. I mean, part of it's the cancer. Your head is bald. You have this, like, how do you describe the kind of beard that he has?
It's actually called a Van Dyke,
okay.
Which a goatee is just the hair on the chin a la a goat. But the combination of the mustache connecting in with the hair on the chin is called a Van Dyke. So it started off as this, what I called an impotent mustache, which I wanted Walter White at the very beginning to look impotent and weak. And I wanted people to look at the mustache and think to themselves, why bother? Either shave it or grow it or do something. And I wanted that kind of ambiguity to his look. And as he grew in power, that the look would also grow in power. And we discovered that the most powerful look that a man can have, the most aggressive look, is no hair on the head and facial hair.
So I want to play what I think is one of the just best scenes from Breaking Bad. And this has become a kind of iconic scene, and it's the one who knocks scene. And just to set it up, Walt's wife, Skyler, at this point in season 4, episode 6, knows that Walt's cooking meth. And she knows that Walt's in danger, and she believes, she has no idea the evil acts that Walt has done. She doesn't know that in addition to cooking meth, that you've killed people, that you've done horrible things.
Well, you know, horrible to one man is necessary to another.
That's right. So anyway, she's thinking, you know, my husband, he's just like cooking meth. He did it for a reason, to help the family. So, Walt, what you've got to do is just go to the police. So in this scene, she's trying to convince you that that's all you need to do is, like, turn yourself in and explain what happened. So here is a very famous scene from Breaking Bad with Anna Gunn as Skyler and my guest Bryan Cranston as Walter White.
Walt, I've said it before. If you are in danger, we go to the police.
No, I don't want to hear about the police.
I do not say that lightly. I know what it could do to this family, but if it's the only real choice we have, if it's either that or you getting shot when you open your front door...
I don't want to hear about the police.
You're not some hardened criminal, Walt. You are in over your head. No. That's what we tell them, and that's the truth.
No, it's not the truth.
Of course it is. School teacher cancer... Desperate for money?
Okay, we're done here.
Roped into working for... Unable to even quit? You told me that yourself, Walt. Jesus, what was I thinking? Walt, please. Let's both of us stop trying to justify this whole thing and admit you're in danger.
Who are you talking to right now? Who is it you think you see? Do you know how much I make a year? I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up. Disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
I just can't hear that scene too many times.
Wow.
That's so
I haven't heard that in a while. It's,
really?
It's good to revisit
that. Great scene. So when you first read those lines, which are so terrific, did you know how you were going to read them? Like, did you try them all kinds of different ways before getting the version that we heard?
No. And, you know, listening to that again, it's just a testament to the writing staff of Breaking Bad, led by Vince Gilligan. And in that one scene, you have two opposing viewpoints that are equally valid from their point of view. Skyler is worried about her family. She makes a very pragmatic pitch. Just confess. Stop it now. Don't do this. You're going to put yourself and us in danger. But Walt, by then, is too far along in his journey. His ego has been opened, and he is fully realizing his sense of power, and he likes it, and he is not about to, you know, go back into the shell that he originally came out of. And he's taking her comments as demeaning, as pejorative, that you're not who you say you are. You're not a powerful person. You're a little school teacher. Just go back to that. And all I'm hearing is, you're not a man. You're not this powerful, great Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. You're just Walter White, this little man. You know, and he's so far beyond that at that moment. He now has to express himself with his full range of hubris, and that's what comes out.
And that scene is a great example of how your voice changed while playing Walter White, because it starts off kind of similar in the voice that you're talking in now, and it ends up in that much deeper, huskier voice.
You know, a lower voice is always a little more intimidating, isn't it? You know, has a little more gravitas to it. And so I wanted to drop it just, maybe not a full register, but, you know, something noticeable.
Let's hear the scene that helped you get your starring role in Breaking Bad. You were in The X-Files, which Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad, had been working on. And in this episode, which apparently made a really big impression on Vince Gilligan, you guest starred as Patrick Crump, who's a racist, anti-Semite, seemingly deranged, and
but otherwise sweet guy.
Nice guy. And he's trapped, FBI agent Mulder, David Duchovny, in a car and has him driving at high speed. And so your character thinks that he's a victim of some kind of weird conspiracy that's gotten deep into his head, that's like embedded into his head. Mm-hmm. And what we don't know yet is that he actually is. Actually is a victim of the government. Yeah. So anyway, so here you are in the car, in the back seat. David Duchovny is driving, and David Duchovny is Agent Mulder. Speaks first, because your wife has already died of this whatever it is that you think is trapped in your head and was also trapped in hers.
I'm sorry about your wife.
I'm sure you are. You and the rest of your Jew FBI.
Crump.
Oh, yeah. You think I don't know, huh? You think I'm just some ignorant puttknucker, don't you? But I get it, man! I see what this is. I am not sick, and I do not have the flu. Vicky and me were just some kind of government guinea pigs.
You think the government did this to you?
Oh, hell yeah. Who else? You see it all the time on the TV. They're dropping Agent Orange. They're putting radiation in little retarded kids' gonads. Oh, yeah. You sons of bitches sneaking around my woods at night. I seen you. You think I don't know?
Well, on behalf of the International Jewish Conspiracy, I just need to inform you that we're almost out of gas.
David Duchovny and my guest Bryan Cranston in a scene from The X-Files from 1998. Was that an unusual part for you at the time, this racist extremist, tormented on the verge of hysteria kind of guy? Were you paranoid and threatening?
No. I made the rounds of guest starring roles on many, many television series and usually playing the bad guy of the week, which is basically the role that men had in series television, as opposed to women playing usual victim of the week kind of thing. and that's what, another reason why Breaking Bad broke the mold. But there you find another example in the writing that Vince was able to do, is that he went another level deeper than what you would expect. And that's why X-Files became the show that it did, with that kind of sensibility behind it, where an average show would have written Crump to be a nice guy, a sweet guy. Therefore, the audience would want David Duchovny to save this man. He's a nice man. But the audience wouldn't be invested in that. It would just be an automatic, he's a nice guy. But because he wrote me as this despicable character saying awful things, it put the emotional dilemma in his central character. It gave the power to Duchovny, which is absolutely right. Do I save this man simply because he's a human being, when what he really wants to do is pull over, stop, and say, Crump, see ya. Go ahead and die, because you're an awful person, and no one's going to miss you. But he can't, because he's human. And he and despite the actions of this man, he is still worth saving. So that's the germ of Breaking Bad. That was the seed, that he felt that I would be right for this role because Crump was a character that was doing despicable things and still was able to convey a sense of vulnerability and to receive sympathy. And that's what he felt that Walter White needed.
A lot of us noticed you on Seinfeld in your recurring role as Dr. Tim Whatley, Jerry's dentist. And mm-hmm. we've stitched two scenes together here. In the first, you meet Jerry and George at the coffee shop, where you reveal you've converted to Judaism. And in mm-hmm. the second scene, you're in your dentist's office working on Jerry's teeth, playing up how Jewish you've become. So in the opening of this clip, which again is in the coffee shop, Jerry and George ask you what's up.
I'll tell you what's up. I'm a Jew.
Excuse me?
I'm a Jew. I finished converting 2 days ago.
Oh, well. Welcome aboard.
Thanks. So I'll see you tomorrow?
Yeah, I have a cavity lower left.
Hey, were you just at the health club?
Oh, yeah.
No, we must have just missed you.
Ah, well, I didn't do much. I just sat in the sauna. You know, it was more like a Jewish workout. That's it. Which reminds me, did you hear the one about the rabbi and the farmer's daughter? Huh?
Hey,
Those aren't matzo balls. What?
Tim, do you think you should be making jokes like that?
Why not? I'm Jewish, remember?
I know, but...
Jerry, it's our sense of humor that sustained us as a people for 3,000 years.
5,000.
5,000, even better. Okay. Chrissy, give me a shtickle of fluorite.
Did you have to ask what shtickle meant?
No, I knew what it meant.
It's a little bit off, yeah. So you're very funny in that. Did you? I read that you did stand up for a while early in your career. Is that right?
I did. I did it in for about 9 months in 1981, I believe it was, and I did it solely for the purpose of overcoming fear. As I looked at that and I said to myself, oh, man, that's got to be the scariest thing to do. Just stand there. There's a microphone and a light on you, and that's it. It's all you. And so I wanted to do that, and I got into the idea of going from club to club. I was never paid for it, nor should I have been, because I never rose above the level of mediocrity. And but it was a great experience, very, very humbling, and my respect and admiration for those who do it for a living, like Jerry, was just, you know, enormous.
Tell us something about what your act was like.
It was observational. I did a series of, you know, talking about, you know, how out of Detroit, there's been a reduction in the amount of cars that are being sold. And, you know, they should really appeal to men to buy more cars because women are now becoming the decision makers. They're the one who are emotionally connected to it, and they convince their husbands or boyfriends, this is the car I want to get. But in order to get men to buy cars, we're such simple beasts. All you need to do is name these cars after women's body parts, and they'll buy them. Like the cute little Ford nipple. It's peppy. You know? And I went on down a list of them. You know, or that import, that very safe import, the Volvo. You know? And I finished with, and who can resist? And guys, once you step into the new Dodge Vagina, you'll never want to get out. You know, I mean, It was, I don't know.
How did it go over?
Sometimes I got some decent laughs, and other times it was crickets. But then you never know, because the times that I had been given were sometimes, 1:48 in the morning. You're the last one. Turn off the lights when you're done.
Yeah.
So everybody's drunk already, and so you might even get great laughs there, and then you take that same material to a sober audience, and they go, not so funny. So, and you saw why.
it's a great story. I want to ask you your favorite TV shows and movies of all time, maybe the ones that had the biggest influence on you in your formative years growing up.
Well, the movie that had the most impact on me was one that probably no one else will select, and that's because it's very personal. And that's Cat Ballou with Jane Fonda and Lee Marvin. I believe it was early 1968 or late 1967. And my parents were going through a terrible time. And this was right before their breakup, the official splitting off. And my dad had leased a bar and coffee shop in the Corbin Bowl on Ventura Boulevard in Tarzana in California. And it was not doing well. And right next door to this cafe, and then we were young, I was 12, was the Corbin Theater. And they were playing Cat Ballou at this very critical time when we were there most of the night because we did our homework on one of the coffee shop tables. And when we were done, we were able to go over to the theater, and they made arrangements with the theater owner. We got in free, and they gave him a free lunch and that sort of thing. And my brother and I would go and watch this so that we can escape the tension of what my parents were doing. And we got to memorize this movie. Every single line of this movie we memorized. And we would go back home, and when they were still arguing, we would be in our room and we would do the entire movie over again. And so from an early age, we were using that theatrical experience as an escape mechanism, where someone may take a glass of wine or whatever to escape that emotional crisis they may be in. We were escaping an emotional crisis by reinventing art. I look at it in retrospect, and I have such fondness for this movie, I can't accurately say whether it was a good movie or not. It was a great movie to me because of what it meant.
Bryan Cranston, has been so great to talk with you, and also to just hear your voice speaking as yourself. It's been so much fun.
I am the one who talks.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. And thank you, Terry. It was a delight.
Bryan Cranston is currently starring in the Broadway show All the Way, portraying President Lyndon Johnson. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. It's been 11 years since the United States invaded Iraq and toppled Saddam Hussein. Most of the early stories to come out of that war were by journalists. But in recent years, fiction writers have been exploring the war in such acclaimed novels as Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain and The Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers. The latest to win acclaim is Redeployment, a collection of short stories by Iraq veteran Phil Clay. Our critic at large, John Powers, says that Clay captures the complicated experience of fighting in Iraq more completely than anyone before him.
Here's an old joke you may have heard. How many Vietnam vets does it take to screw in a light bulb? Answer: you wouldn't know. You weren't there. This joke gets told in Redeployment, a stingingly sharp short story collection that itself addresses the gap between the American soldiers who fought in Iraq and those of us back home. It was written by Phil Clay, who does know because he was there. After graduating from Dartmouth, he enlisted in the Marines and served as a public affairs officer in Anbar Province during the 2007 surge. Clay's time there gave him something valuable that, consciously or not, he was surely looking for. Great material. Of course, countless writers start with great material and reduce it to mulch. Clay takes his experience and clarifies it, lucidly tracing the moral, political, and psychological curlicues of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Like Tim O'Brien in his great Vietnam book, The Things They Carried, Clay is conscious of how lived life gets translated into stories. His first-person tales take us inside an array of characters, from a Marine who tells us about handling dead bodies, to a chaplain offering guidance to soldiers whose closeness to violent death makes them skeptical about God. In the blackly hilarious story, Money is a Weapon System, a provincial reconstruction official tries to rebuild the area near Tikrit, only to have a fortune in American aid be lost to local corruption and an American millionaire's demented mission to teach the Iraqis baseball. The wrenching title story, Redeployment, begins the whole book with two short, chilling sentences. We shot dogs, not by accident, and weaves this into a metaphor for both the war and for returning home. Now, writers in earlier times often took a grand, even godlike view of war. Think of Tolstoy in War and Peace. Or at least they stayed comfortably inside the action in novels like The Naked and the Dead or The Thin Red Line. War stories these days tend to be fractured and self-conscious, as if a grand overview would be false. Clay quite pointedly doesn't offer a big vision, only a mosaic of smaller ones. In fact, what makes him so good is the way he can carry us from the battlefield to the strip bar, from the funny to the harrowing to the heartbreaking. This may have something to do with the nature of America's most recent wars. Where World War II felt conceptually clean, our soldiers were fighting an evil enemy's army, the wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan have been anything but. They've involved moving among civilians you're theoretically trying to save, but who may try to kill you, and whom you often kill back, sometimes accidentally. Such warfare is more surreal than clean. And it feels even more disorienting when, stoked by video games, knocked out by Ambien, and speaking in the obfuscating patois of military acronyms, the soldiers are performing a dangerous and brutal mission they suspect their country doesn't really believe in and would rather not think about. Heck, Americans won't even go to movies about our ongoing wars. Clay makes you feel the physical and psychic costs demanded of our soldiers in Iraq. And he may be even better on what it means to return to an America that pays gaudy lip service to honoring the troops, yet doesn't try to understand their service. Because we have a volunteer army, our soldiers and vets remain weirdly invisible to their fellow countrymen. Some of Redeployment's keenest moments show us returning soldiers' frustration in trying to communicate their disturbing, often ineffable experience to people who greet them with clichés, however well-meaning. As one vet tells us, there's a perversity in me that, when I talk to conservatives, makes me want to bash the war, and when I talk to liberals, defend it. Redeployment is so wonderfully written, it's a pleasure to read. Yet it's hard not to be saddened by what an ill-conceived mess the war in Iraq proved to be. After so much money and sacrifice, you'd hope to wind up with stories happier than the ones Clay tells us. Which isn't to say that he smacks us with an obvious or strident political message. On the contrary, you're struck by the gnawing, sometimes stunned ambivalence that Clay's characters feel about the whole enterprise. His vets usually wind up feeling diminished, even soiled by what they had to do in Iraq, but also superior to the America they were doing it for. You risked your life for something bigger than yourself, one explains. How many people can say that?
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue. He reviewed Redeployment, Phil Clay's new short story collection. If you love New Yorker cartoons, you'd probably love the view from Bob Mankoff's desk. As the New Yorker's cartoon editor, he evaluates more than 500 cartoons every week. Mankoff became the cartoon editor in 1997, 20 years after selling his first cartoon to the magazine. The cartoon for which he's most famous shows an executive at his desk on the phone looking at his calendar saying, "No, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you?" The title of Mankoff's new memoir is taken from that caption. It's called, "How About Never? Is Never Good for You?" The book is filled with cartoons and insights about them. Terry spoke with Bob Mankoff earlier this week.
Bob Mankoff, welcome back to Fresh Air. So, do you remember how you came up with the idea of how about never is never good for you?
I absolutely do. I was trying to get on the phone, and I did get on the phone with a friend of mine, quote-unquote friend, who I wanted to see. And somehow that person didn't want to see me, it seemed. You know, I kept saying, well, could we do it this time? Could we do it that time? And then I just got exasperated with him and said, how about never? Is never good for you? So it was really a snotty line. And when I look back on it, on my Queens and Bronx and New York Jewish background, it's sort of like, hey, if I never see you again, it'll be too soon. It, the underlying structure is that. So I do remember it, and I didn't think anything of it, really, except this was the last thing in the batch. I was going to throw it in and, you know, it's a quip. And it has an executive on the phone looking at the appointment book saying that. So I sort of switched the position so that the guy saying it is in a position of superiority rather than inferiority because it makes it funny. So I handed it in 1993. And that time the editor, art editor and cartoon editor was Lee Lorenz, still a wonderful cartoonist for us. And the editor was Tina Brown. And so the next day, Lee calls me back and says, we want that cartoon for A issue. A issue is the next issue that's coming out. And usually that really is only for cartoons that are completely topical because, you know, why do you need it right away? I mean, cartoons often that you do for the New Yorker don't appear for months afterwards. And the record for that is a cartoon that was bought by James Stevenson in 1987 and didn't appear until 2000. So I said, well, why does Tina want this right away? She said, because she loves this cartoon. She just thinks this is a great cartoon. And, you know, it turned out to be one of the most reprinted cartoons in, I think, New Yorker history. We don't have records going all the way back. And certainly my most reprinted cartoon. And certainly, this is a little macabre. I mean, I don't think most people know what's going to be in their obituary, but I do.
Oh, yeah, but not on your tombstone, right?
Not on my... Well, Johnny Carson had I'll Be Right Back. So, which just seemed very optimistic. Not on my tombstone.
So in your book, you write that you have to look at about 500 cartoons a week. And because you're the cartoon editor at The New Yorker, and you say evaluating humor is different from enjoying humor. And to demonstrate, you have a cartoon with 10 possible captions. And this is what you have to do all the time for the cartoon caption contest that you run each week, where you put a cartoon on the page and readers have to come up with captions. And it's a contest and you reprint the winners. So this cartoon that you reprint with 10 possible captions is two snakes walking side by side. And one of them in the middle of the snake body has a bulge that looks like two buttocks.
Very calipiginous buttocks.
Calipiginous? What does that mean?
Right. It means very well-shaped buttocks.
Thank you.
So now you can, I don't know how often you can use that in conversation without getting slapped.
Okay. So I want you to read the 10 possible captions.
Okay. So the captions are, did you see the look on Darwin's face? I don't like the way Adam looks at you. That happens when you eat Brazilian. Now you probably want a chair. Those Kardashians are hard to swallow. I'm telling you, the apple will be tempting enough. It's hot now, but tomorrow it'll be somewhere near your ankles. All he gave me to work with was a lousy apple. I told you silicon was non-digestible. It's not my fault that my brain is not evolutionarily wired to like that. Please stop asking, honey. If anything, you look too thin. If only I had hands, Gladys. If only I had hands. So there you have all the choices. And one of the things, you know, there's a book, The Paradox of Choice. But one of the things about choice and humor and just the interference of the judgment process is it automatically is a mediating response and it short circuits your laugh response. Now instead of laughing at it something, as you would in a normal cartoon, you're having to judge it. And for one thing, that makes everything less funny, but you still have to, you know, you still have to judge it.
So which did you pick? Which did you think was the funniest?
You know, I thought the funniest was, I don't like the way Adam looks at you.
I thought the funniest was, did you see the look on Darwin's face?
But you see, you're wrong.
Why am I wrong?
No, you're not. So humor itself and your response to humor, that's one of the things that I learned in doing this job and even writing this book, especially the caption contest, is very, very varied. And there's a huge amount of variability between subjects. And there's even great variability within a person. At another time, you might choose something different. Probably because you're smart and intellectual and you like that association with Darwin, you know, I think that's why that worked for you. But what we do is after we look through all 5,000, and usually it's my assistant, and usually the assistant is someone from the Harvard Lampoon, looks through all 5,000, categorizes them in all different ways the jokes are made, then I pick maybe these many, and I use SurveyMonkey, and I send it out to the New Yorker editors. And just like you, the response is incredibly varied. But at that point, it's sort of this—it's this crowdsourcing. And you know what? I'll sort of tend to go with the one that the crowd likes at that point, because in the end, there's another crowd who's going to pick, and who vote on it. But all of these—one of the things is all of these are actually pretty good. When you look at it, of what the caption contest is, which is a game. So I try to evaluate it not so much as, is this hysterically funny? But if you were playing this game, like a board game, and you came up with this, would you think you did a pretty good job? I think for all of these, you'd think I did okay.
You know, in giving advice to you about cartoon humor, you mentioned, like, if you're doing a list or mentioning alternatives, there's got to be at least three, that two isn't enough. And I've heard stand-up comics talk about the law of threes. So what's the magic of three?
I think the magic of three is sort of what I talked about before in terms of surprise. You need a sequence for surprise. So let's look at a joke by Alex Gregory. You know, it's two cavemen, and they're saying, I don't understand it. The air is pure. Everything we eat is organic, and yet we only live to 30. or another one. This is a great cartoon by Alex Gregory, which also really shows this thing that in professional comedy is called a triplet, which is one, two, and then boom, the punchline. The woman is saying, I started my vegetarianism for moral reasons, then for health concerns, and now it's just to annoy people. So by setting it up, and also the two things about it is that the final thing, the final part, the punchline always must diminish. It can't raise. It can't elevate. I did a cartoon that's a little bit like that, but it's a visual cartoon in which it shows three doors, and we're looking, you know, left to right. So the first door is accounting department, the second door is legal department, and the third door is jail. So one, two, three. So you're always looking at, you are ridiculing something. You're making fun of something. That's really the fun of humor. There is humor that's just whimsy that we smile at, but the humor that we laugh at, someone has to be... someone's dignity has to be reduced.
So you write a little bit about different editors of The New Yorker that you've worked under. And when you joined the magazine in the 70s, William Shawn was the editor, and he's famous for being very circumspect about anything sexual. It was hard to get anything sexual into the magazine. And so you
would not have a calipiginous snake.
That's right.
No way.
For Sean, no. Any suggestion of real sex was taboo. But when Tina Brown was editor, and this was starting in the 90s?
91, I believe.
Yeah, when she was editor, the propriety pendulum swung in the other direction. So while the pendulum swung in the other direction, did you do any cartoons that you think would never have made it under Sean?
Yeah, I did a cartoon which Tina bought, which a guy is saying to his wife in bed, they're both reading, and he's saying, oh, you're right. Tonight isn't reading night. Tonight is sex night. So So that would never, you know, I don't. None of the cartoons that I ever did, you know, are you know, basically they're about sex, they're about sex in sort of this you know, this ironic way, or the way that people actually treat it. So I think Tina really opened up the magazine in a necessary way, and maybe the pendulum did go, you know, too far. You know, under Tina, we bought a joke where there's a guy is getting an exam, and the doctor has the rubber glove, and the guy who's about to get that exam is saying, "Does this make me your bitch?" I know, but it just seemed one of the things is the New Yorker is very, very. The New Yorker is, and I point this out in the book. It's an empathetic environment. It's not that is hysterical, but it might not be hysterical in the New Yorker. It might not be hysterical in a magazine.
But you bought that one, right?
We did.
Yeah.
We did. Tina bought it. But just to show you how sensitive the readers of the New Yorker can be, I mean, I talk about this within the context of one of the theories of humor called benign violation. And benign violation, to shorten it, is, you know, Las Vegas had that ad, just the right amount of wrong.
Yeah.
Well, that's how jokes work, right? But just the right amount of wrong is different in different contexts. And, for instance, even in cartoons that we print, okay, here's one, and here's, like, the reaction. And we printed this cartoon. So there's two surgeons, and there's a child on the table. And one surgeon is saying to the other, there's got to be an easier way to get candy from a baby. And we got so many letters from people, you know, saying, you know, how widespread child abuse is and how many children are injured or die. And I do think it's perfectly okay to run that cartoon, because really these cartoons are complete fantasy. There are no surgeons. No one is getting hurt. Or another example is a cartoon that we ran in which it's lab technicians, and they're looking at a rodent, and the rodent has hung himself. And the caption is, "Discouraging data on the antidepressant." You know, okay, so one of these things, so all of those work, but we get many, many letters saying, "I don't think that's funny. I don't like to see animals suffer. I don't like to see them suffer even in cartoons."
But really, can you let that guide you? Because there are some people who have no sense of humor at all, and they're hypersensitive about things.
We don't let that guide us. But on the other hand, we are aware of people's sensitivities. So after some terrible tragedy in which guns are used, we're not going to have any gun cartoons in the magazine.
Sure. Well, that's different. Yeah.
You know, okay, so, but I think it's
different. Yeah.
It is different, but it's a continuum. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So where's the pendulum under you? If the pendulum was like no sex under Sean and be more transgressive under Tina.
Wait a second. It's not under me. It's under David Remnick. He is the ultimate.
Yeah.
I think for me, I become a little bit more sensitive. I don't. What I never want to do is offend intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be that the purpose of it. But if it's something like this, that, and you're not offending intentionally, and that you have to understand that humor itself shouldn't be a scapegoat for essentially everything in entertainment. We watch thrillers and murder mysteries and CSI and Shakespeare, and all sorts of horrible things are happening. One of the things you realize is that humor is a coping mechanism. We have so many cartoons about the Grim Reaper because, okay, death is the ultimate reality, and one of the ways we cope with our anxiety about death and illness is actually through humor. Some of the cartoons that I like the most are just, you know, Grim Reaper cartoons. One of mine that I think is pretty good, in which the Grim Reaper is taking away the husband, and the woman's at the apartment door, and she's saying, "Relax, Harry, change is good."
You have some very funny cartoons about marriage.
Yeah.
And you mentioned in the book you've been married three times?
I have been married 3 times, and it just keeps getting better and better, but I'm going to stop here.
So one of your cartoons is a man's talking to a woman over drinks, and he says, look, I can't promise I'll change, but I can promise I'll pretend to change. And then another one is a man talking to a woman in the living room, and he says, believe me, Janet, I consider you an important part of our marriage. And I'm wondering if anybody who you were previously married to took offense.
What about the person I'm now married to?
Well, because you could always say about my previous wives.
Right, with previous wives, right. Right. No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm making fun of myself, and I think I'm making fun of all men and our desperate, desperate attempt to understand the people we're with and hopefully through humor have them understand us. And I do find that humor helps in relationships. It certainly helps in my marriage now because I'm a very, very fallible person. And if I wasn't funny, I'd be kicked right out the door.
Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker. His new memoir is called How About Never? Is Never Good for You? You'll find a longer version of Mankoff's conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org.